Deuteronomy 30, verses 19 and 20. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. So choose life in order that you may live, you and your descendants, by loving the Lord your God, by obeying his voice, and by holding fast to him. For this is your life and the length of your days, that you may live in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them.
Well, I have another question for you this evening. It comes from 1 Kings chapter 18. 1 Kings chapter 18, some of you are all aquiver with excitement already because you recognize 1 Kings chapter 18, one of the most exciting stories in all of the Bible. It has to do with Elijah, and of course Elijah is one of the most focal figures in all of Scripture. And clearly here in 1 Kings 18, where he challenges the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, is one of those exciting stories of the Bible. In so many ways, we are thrilled by that story. One, the vindication of what is right, the putting in place of those things that are wrong, the kind of humor that goes along with that in some ways as well. You may remember the background to that story. 1 Kings chapter 18 is set in the reign of Ahab and Jezebel. And of course, when you say Ahab and Jezebel, you're talking about some of the most wicked people in all of the Bible. Ahab and Jezebel had introduced widespread Baal worship into the countryside among the people of God, among those very people to whom Moses had spoken the words of God that were read just a moment ago. Choose this day, heaven, as heaven is your witness, choose this day, life or death. I have set them before you. And of course, implicit in all of that is the first commandment, that there is but one God, and you shall have but one God, and you shall have no other gods before him, and you shall make no graven images. Yet over and over again, we see this very thing happening. And because of their worship of the idols, the famine and the drought has come upon the land. And it is Elijah who is the prophet that God sends with the message to say to them, for 3.5 years, there will be no rain upon the land, not even any dew. 1 Kings 17 and verse 1. And you consider the severity of a 3.5 year drought. 3.5 years without rain. 3.5 years without any significant dew. And of course, for that 3.5 years, they were searching out every bit of water that they could find to try and keep them livestock alive, try and keep themselves alive over that 3.5 years of drought. And of course, the focus is on that man who made the announcement, on Elijah. And Ahab is searching for him everywhere, either to get him to retract his demand that there be no rain on the land for 3.5 years, or to punish him for bringing that upon the land. So over 3.5 years, they're looking for water and they're looking for Elijah. And then in 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 7, all of a sudden there he is, Elijah. 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 7. Now as Obadiah was on his way, suddenly Elijah met him, and he recognized him, and he fell on his face, and he says, "Is that you, my Lord Elijah?" And he answered him, "It is I." I'm always impressed by his good grammar there. "It is I," he said. "It is I," he said. "Go tell your master, Elijah is here." So he said, "How have I sinned that you're delivering your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my master has not sent someone to hunt for you. And when they said he is not here, he took an oath from the kingdom or nation that they could not find you. And now you say, 'Go tell your master Elijah is here.' And it shall come to pass as soon as I am gone from you that the Spirit of the Lord will carry you to a place I do not know. So when I go and tell Ahab and he cannot find you, he will kill me." But of course, Elijah is there at the Lord's behest. And so he confronts Ahab and he says, "You go and tell him that I am here." What significance that is when Elijah is there. Always kind of an interesting question to ask ourselves, though not the one that we're going to consider this evening. And that is, does it mean anything when we tell people that we are there? Does it mean anything that we are present or that we are not? Elijah stood for something. Stood for something pretty important. And when they said, "Behold, Elijah is here," everybody was pretty impressed by that. Something was about to happen. And so it does. In 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 17, it happened when Ahab saw Elijah that Ahab said to him, "Is that you, O troubler of Israel?" And he answered, "I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, in that you've forsaken the commandments of the Lord and have followed the Baals. Now therefore send and gather all Israel to me to Mount Carmel, the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of the Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." So Ahab sent for all the children of Israel, gathered the prophets together on Mount Carmel. Right away, we're impressed by the curious phenomena that has occurred here. A king has been searching kingdoms for this one man. This man probably that he wants to kill. In fact, he has taken an oath of all those kingdoms. He is not here. He is not here. And when finally Elijah shows up, this man for whom Ahab has been searching, instead of killing him, he obeys his commandment. And he brings together a great assembly at Mount Carmel. A great assembly, because there's going to be a great test. A test of whether God is God or whether the Baal are God. It wasn't, of course, Elijah's idea. Elijah, if you know anything at all about him, is not the kind of guy who would have come up with this idea. He was pretty afraid for his life in the same way that Obadiah was in the presence of Ahab and the even worse evil of Jezebel. It wasn't Elijah's idea that he'd bring about this confrontation. It was God's idea. And it wasn't Elijah that brought about the cooperation of Ahab to bring about this great assembly and this great test. No, in fact, it was God who brought about all of those things to happen. I'm not sure what was working in Ahab's mind, how directly God influenced him, but I am confident that it is God who has brought this about at Mount Carmel. And so we travel to Mount Carmel, which is up at the northwestern part of Israel, over on the Mediterranean Sea side. It's about 600 feet straight up out of the sea. It runs down toward the southeast, down to the plain of Esdraelon. It is about 1,000 feet high, tabletop. And up on that land, the rest of it mostly flat. You can look up and you can see pretty clearly what is going on there. And you can imagine the great assembly of Israel gathered in the plain and looking up to see what is going on up there, where Elijah is gathered by himself with the 450 prophets of the Baal and the 400 prophets of the Asherah, the female idol that they worshipped. And when the people came, you wonder what they were expecting. Surely they were hoping that he would bring rain. But before he will bring the blessings of God on this people, he has other work to do. And that is, first of all, those who are deserters have to return to the camp of the Lord. Those disobedient to God must become obedient and repent. They must know for certainty that it is God who is blessing them and not the Baal. You can imagine the kind of worship that has been going on in this land over the 3.5 years. This frantic kind of effort to bring about rain. They have prayed, of course, to God, the Jehovah God that they knew before, and that this is really the God who can bring the rain. But they have certainly made their sacrifices to Baal and to the Asherah and to every other kind of minor deity they can possibly scrape together. They've probably done their rain dances, and they've taken out their wicking sticks, and they've looked for water everywhere, any way they possibly could. That's their problem, is they haven't trusted to God. They haven't put their confidence in the one God, the God who can give them water and bring them rain. And that's where the question comes in. And you know already what the question is that we want to ask ourselves tonight. It's the very same question that God poses to these Israelites way back then in the days of Elijah. 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 21. Elijah came to the people and he said, "How long will you halt between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him." But the people answered him, not a word. How long, he says, will you halt, limp, hop, falter, hesitate between two opinions? You got two ideas going here, and they're incompatible with one another. The idea that God is God and you can pray to God and he will bless you, or the idea that the Baals have some kind of power and that they can bring rain. How long are you going to kind of keep one foot in each camp? You can't keep this up forever. God's not going to put up with it forever. How long are you going to halt between two opinions before you finally make up your mind? Of course, they understood about Jehovah God. They were, after all, the people of God. They were of Israel. They were the called of Abraham. They were in the promised land. They knew all the history about God's dealing with them, bringing them out of Egypt. And, of course, they knew, too, how God had punished those who were disobedient to him, all the way from the traveling 40 years in the wilderness, both so that those stiff-necked people that had come out of Egypt would die, and then their descendants would inherit the land, all the way down to the present day. But they were afraid of Jezebel, too. And somehow they were like, I don't know, maybe there is something to the Baal. Maybe there's something to the Asherah. There's something here. We ought to just not give up one for the sake of the other. So we'll make sacrifices to God and pray to him, but we'll make sacrifices to Baal too. And Elijah comes to them and he says, you got to make up your mind. You got to decide. Are you the people of God or are you not? And in order to make it possible for them to make a decision, once again, God is going to give them some evidence. This is what the test is about. 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 22. Elijah said to the people, I alone am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Therefore, let them give us two bulls, and let them choose one bull for themselves, and cut it in pieces, and lay it on the wood, and put no fire under it, and I will prepare the other bull, and lay it on the wood, and put no fire under it. And then you call on the name of your gods, and I will call on the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God. So all the people answered and said, that's well spoken. Now Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose one bull for yourselves and prepare it first. For you are many, and call on the name of your God, but put no fire under it. And here's the test. And a fair test it is, too. Baal is supposedly the god of fire. Because that's the way the Canaanites did things. That's the way the pagans always did things. One god was in control of one thing. One god was in control of another. And, of course, Baal was in charge of fire. And Baal, of course, is also in charge of bulls. In fact, that's where we get our English word for bull from Baal. So it's like more than fair. He's playing in Baal's camp, if there is any such thing as Baal. Here he is playing by Baal's rules with fire and bulls. And so, I don't know. I got no idea about these prophets of Baal, these priests of Baal. They seem like maybe they're pretty sincere people. I don't really understand them at all. They're like grown men, and they have been priests of Baal for a long time. But it's just an example of how we can probably fool ourselves to believe anything we want to believe. Because they seem pretty sincere about thinking, maybe, somehow, this time, Baal can actually start a fire and consume this bull. 1 Kings 18 and verse 26. They took the bull which given them, and they prepared it, and they called on the name of Baal from morning till noon, saying, O Baal, hear us. But there was no voice. No one answered. And then they leapt about the altar which they had made. So it was at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, and I know I'm a bad person, but I really like this part. You do too, don't you? Yeah. And Elijah mocked them and said, cry aloud, for he's a god. Either he's meditating, or he is busy, or he's on a journey, or maybe he's sleeping and must be awakened. So they cried aloud and cut themselves, as was their custom, with knives and lances, till the blood gushed out on them. And when midday was past, they prophesied until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice. But there was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. And there's a reason why no one answered and no one paid attention, because there wasn't anyone. There is no Baal. You can imagine, 450 priests, and they're all leaping about and cutting themselves and shouting and praying and making a spectacle of themselves. And you can't blame Elijah for ridiculing them, because it's a pretty ridiculous sight to observe. Reason is wasted on stupidity. Ridicule really is sometimes the righteous response for this kind of nonsense. It ought to be true, of course, that as Christians, we really need to give most people the benefit of the doubt for their sincerity. But there are some things that are just beyond the pale. It is just silly, and you ought to point out that it is silly. Psalm 2 and verse 4. Of course, this is God, but this is our attitude as well. Psalm 2 and verse 4, he that sits in the heaven shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision. Because they're powerless, and yet they think they're so powerful, and they're opposing the God of heaven. Amazing. And you can't doubt their sincerity. They began early, they persisted, they threw themselves into their work. I mean, they were like literally bleeding for the sake of what they believed in. You know, it's amazing. If only there were people who worked that hard for the true God. But for all of their sincerity and their fervor, their God was nothing but a contemptible idol of no real power. Not only Elijah, but all the other prophets had recognized the foolishness and the contrast between the worship of these false gods, these idols that were weak and powerless, and the God of heaven and earth who had created all things. Isaiah 44, just one of the passages in which Isaiah himself mocks these idol worshipers. Isaiah 44 and verse 9. Those who fashion a graven image are all of them futile, and their precious things are of no profit. Even their own witnesses fail to see or know, so that they will be put to shame. Who's fashioned a god or cast an idol to no profit? Behold, all his companions will be put to shame, for the craftsmen themselves are mere men. Let them all assemble themselves. Let them stand up. Let them tremble. Let them together be put to shame. The man shapes iron into a cutting tool, and he does his work over the coals, fashioning with hammers and working it with his strong arm. And he gets hungry, and his strength fails, and he drinks no water, and he becomes weary. And another shapes wood. He extends a measuring line. He outlines it with red chalk. He works it with planes and outlines it with a compass, and he makes it like the form of a man, like the beauty of a man, so that it may sit in a house. Surely he cuts cedars for himself, and he takes a cypress or an oak, and he raises it for himself among the trees of the forest, and he plants a fir, and the rain makes it grow. And then it becomes something for a man to burn. So he takes one of them and warms himself, and he makes a fire to bake bread. And he also makes a god and worships it. And he makes it a graven image, and he falls down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire, and over this half he eats meat as he roasts a roast and is satisfied. And he warms himself, and he says, "Ah, I am warm, I have seen the fire." But the rest of it, he makes into a god, his graven image. He falls down before it, and he worships, and he also prays to it. And he says, "Deliver me, for you are my God." And they do not know. They do not understand. For he is smeared over their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so they cannot comprehend. And no one recalls, nor is there knowledge or understanding to say, "I have burned half of it in the fire, baked bread over the coals. I roast meat and eat it. And then I make the rest of it into an abomination. I fall down before a block of wood." It is just silliness. You can't measure the truth of a philosophy or a religion by the sincerity of those who profess it. You can't measure the truth of a philosophy or a religion by the fervor with which they practice it. You can't measure it by the eloquence with which they talk about it. What you have to measure it by is the same thing that we always measure by, the efficacy. What's the end result of that? There's nothing, nothing that Baal could do. That's why God set this test. That's why the people said, "That's a good idea, let's do that." And the foolishness of the priest of Baal to say, "Okay, let's do that." They believed, apparently, but there's no power there. And then the answer comes. 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 30. Elijah said to all the people, "Come near to me." So all the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord that was broken down. And Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob to whom the word of the Lord had come. And he said, "Israel shall be your name." And with stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. And he made a trench around the altar large enough to hold 2 bushels of seed. And he put the wood in order, and he cut the bull in pieces, and he laid it on the wood. And he said, fill four water pots with water and pour it on the burnt sacrifice and on the wood. And then he said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. He said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. So the water ran all around the altar, and he also filled the trench with water. Can you imagine? Here it is, a drought. 3.5 years they've been hoarding water. They've been searching for water. They've been desperate for water. And he says, you pour the water on the sacrifice. Do it again. Do it again. Water's just dripping around everywhere. And of course, why would they do that sort of thing? Except that the Lord has inspired them to do that. Except that they hope, they believe, they have confidence that the Lord can make up for the deficit in the water if he chooses to do so. And it came to pass at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, and note the difference between the frantic activity of the prophets, the priest of Baal, and the simple prayer of Elijah's. Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and I am your servant, and that I've done all these things at your word. Hear me, O Lord, hear me, that this people may know that you are the Lord God, and that you've turned their hearts back to you again. And then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trenches. And there was no doubt about who was God, as if there ever had been a doubt about who was God, as if there had ever been any possibility that Baal was God, that Baal could do such a thing as this. But the God of heaven and earth could, and he did. And in 1 Kings 18 and verse 39, when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. And Elijah said to them, seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let one of them escape. So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook of Kishon, and he executed them there. And some people, of course, are critical of Elijah for his lack of mercy on this occasion. As very frequently, they misunderstand what real spiritual values are. That it is Elijah acting again on God's orders here and not on his own. These prophets of Baal have led thousands to forsake God. And they would lead thousands more to forsake God if they were left to it. They have had every opportunity to turn to the worship of the true God, and they're not seized on it. And it may seem to us an awful, terrible thing that he murders them right there. But in some ways, I think we may be applying our weak human values to things we don't really fully understand. We look back at the Crusaders and how horrible and cruel they were, and we condemn them for that. But you think a moment about that. What would the Crusaders think about us? What would Elijah think about us as the people of God? We look at them and we think they are cruel, but they look at us and they think we were soft, effeminate, weak. And God looks at them and he sees their cruelty, I have no doubt. God looks at us and he sees our weakness, I have no doubt. He sees the faults of each equally, probably. But it is a terribly interesting story. It is exciting in all kinds of ways that stories are exciting. Both because it stimulates controversy, because it provokes us to humor, because it raises important questions, because it is just an interesting narrative. But as exciting as the story is, our concern this evening is with the question that God asked the people through Elijah. How long will you halt between two opinions? It is a question for those people standing right there at Mount Carmel, but it really is a question for all the generations of Israel. For all the generations of Israel, right down to that point in time and even into the future, right up to the time of the Babylonian captivity, are going to do this very same thing. They're going to worship God, but they're going to worship the idols. They're going to mix it all up together. Ever since he called them, they have been that way. Even Jacob allowed Rachel to carry the household gods of Laban with her when they came back into the promised land. Aaron made a golden calf for the people while Moses was still on Mount Sinai communing with God after he had delivered them from Egyptian captivity. They failed to destroy all the idols and the idolaters in Canaan under Joshua. They were divided in their loyalty between the Lord and various idols right up to the day that Nebuchadnezzar came in and destroyed Jerusalem and destroyed the temple. Even under Jezebel and Ahab, they'd imported new gods that had not been in the land before. And we're absolutely amazed at this disloyalty, at this foolishness, at this stupidity of the people of God. God had blessed them so richly over and over again. He'd rescued them when idols could not. And the prophets express that same kind of consternation, that same kind of puzzlement. Isaiah chapter 1, the whole book of Isaiah really is just kind of a reiteration of this theme. But Isaiah 1 and verse 2, "Listen, O heavens, and hear, O earth, for the Lord speaks. Sons I have reared and brought up, but they have revolted against me. An ox knows its owner. A donkey knows its master's manger. But Israel does not know. My people do not understand. Alas, sinful nation, people weighed down with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, sons who act corruptly. They've abandoned the Lord. They've despised the Holy One of Israel. They've turned away from Him." Amazing. The question that Isaiah asks over and over, or the complaint that God makes over and over about His people, they don't consider. They don't consider. They don't understand. They don't think about it. And of course, that's easy for us to see when we look at the people of Israel during the days of Elijah. They didn't consider, they didn't understand, they were choosing Baal over God. But what about us? Do we consider? Do we understand? Have we taken a stand? Or do we too halt between two opinions? Do we too compromise with the gods of the world today and taking a stand for Jehovah? Indecision is a cause of loss in every area of life. We all know about that. I mean, we're like all undecided about a host of matters. Some people, of course, more undecided than others, but it's like, what are we going to wear? Got nothing to wear. Put it on, take it off. Well, if that tie's not tied exactly right, maybe we should get another tie. Better have another shirt to go with that tie. We can't make a decision about that. What to eat? I go in and I stand at the, that's why I go to the same place every time and I order the same thing, because then I don't have to worry about it. You know, you go into a new place and you're like, I don't understand what this menu is about up here. And the people behind you just come on and order something. You say, that's why they have numbers on them, you know. Just take number one, say that's okay. What to preach about. Yeah, that's like three sermons discarded. That's just standard. Indecision is worse for major decisions, though. You know, toward the end of the academic year, almost every day I have a discussion with some student about what their career choice is going to be, about what graduate school they're going to go to, or what should they go to graduate school, or should they get married. You know, these are big things. And they, you know, they're just torn from one idea to the other. It's like one possibility. Oh, I should do this. No, I should be a computer programmer. What about big data analysis? I could do that. I said, probably you can't do that, but, you know, it would be a good thing, I guess. And in spiritual matters, it's even worse. That people are lukewarm. Can you imagine that? Revelation chapter 3, you remember that Jesus wrote the letters to the churches, the seven churches of Asia, which really kind of represent the church universal in general. In Revelation 3 and verse 15, I know your works, that you're neither cold nor hot, and I could wish that you were cold or hot, but because you're lukewarm, neither cold nor hot, I will vomit you out of my mouth. Now, he's not saying to people, I'd rather that they were just totally be worshipers of Baal. But the thing is, how can you possibly know enough about God to worship God and then, you know, you also put some confidence in Baal? It's like, why? Why do you do that? Isaiah chapter 55, the prophet Isaiah still continuing this theme about, these people don't understand anything. Isaiah 55 and verse 1. Everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. You who have no money, come buy and eat. Yes, come buy wine and milk and without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for what's not bread and your wages for what does not satisfy? Listen carefully to me. Eat what is good and let your soul be satisfied and delight in abundance. We always think happiness can be found somewhere else. They had God. That's all they needed. God would provide everything else. That's exactly what the Sermon on the Mount talks about. Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, all the rest of these things will be added to you. But no, we can't quite just choose happiness and satisfaction. We got to worry about other kinds of things, like retirement accounts or like career choices or like whether we got the right kind of house with the right kind of granite counters or whatever it is. We always think the other man's grass is greener. Of course, they always told me it's just as hard to mow. But I don't know because I don't have it. Because the torpedo grass in my yard is pretty hard to mow. See, I don't know about those people with the nice, you know, silky green lawns. But the problem is, we're always looking elsewhere. Proverbs 17 and verse 24 kind of sums it up. The eyes of a fool are on the end of the earth. You can't see the things that are right there. The kind of happiness that we could have with God if we just would make a choice and just settle in on that. Paul forsook everything for the sake of following Jesus Christ. And yet he's still happy. Philippians 4 and verse 12, he says, I know how to be abased, I know how to abound everywhere, and in all things I've learned to both be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. Doesn't matter about the external circumstance because he'd chosen God. He wasn't halting between two opinions. He was happy precisely because he'd made a choice, and he was unhesitating about it. And it didn't matter what the cost of it was. He was willing to pay any price, to bear any pain, to suffer any loss. There was no doubt with him wondering, what if? Maybe I should have done this. Maybe I should have done the other. Philippians 1 and verse 21, he explains leading up to Philippians 4 how he's learned to be abased and to be abound and to be content in whatever circumstances he finds himself. Philippians 1 and verse 21, for me to live is Christ, to die is gain. Philippians 3 and verse 7, whatever things were gained to me, these things I've counted as loss for the sake of Christ. More than that, I count all things to be loss in view of the surpassing value of knowing Jesus Christ my Lord, for whom I've suffered the loss of all things, and count them but rubbish so that I may gain Christ. I mean, that's the wholehearted kind of choice. That's the wholehearted kind of choice in which we find contentment. The man who's constantly shuffling from one idea to another is never going to be content. It's not true. Contentment. When we're like, I don't know whether I chose the right job. Maybe I should do this. Maybe I should do the other. You can't be content in a marriage unless you're wholeheartedly committed to that one man, to that one woman. More important than that, you can't be content in spiritual, eternal things unless you have made the choice. Unless you have wholeheartedly committed, just leap into faith and trust God. That's why Moses told those people, Deuteronomy chapter 30, as he's summing up everything he has taught them and everything that he's done with them over the years, as he's come to the last address he's going to make to them in Deuteronomy 30 and verse 19, I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you. I've set before you life and death, blessings and curse. Choose life that both you and your descendants may live. It's what Joshua said in his farewell address as well in Joshua 24 and verse 15. Choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. As for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. There's this responsibility that we have to make, a choice. And the more we know, the heavier the responsibility is. The Apostle Paul says of his period of life before he was a Christian, I was the chiefest of sinners, but I received mercy because I did it in ignorance. We don't have an excuse to be ignorant today. Titus 1 and verse 16 points out the heavy responsibility to his hours. Titus 1 and verse 16, they profess to know God, but in their works they deny Him. They're halting between two opinions. I know this is what God wants me to do, but for the sake of my job, for the sake of my friends, for the sake of my standing in the community, I'm going to do these kind of things. Or maybe tomorrow I will get around to it. Keeping one's options open. As many options as possible for as long as possible. Maybe workable, maybe even wise in a few situations in life. But all of us got to finally decide about the important things. You can't keep waffling about those important things. We have to finally make up our mind. We have to certainly know this is true. When we're interested in the things of God, He's told us long ago that He is a jealous God and that we can have no other gods before us. Truth of the matter is, you just can't keep waiting and waiting and waiting to make up your mind. You can't just keep holding in abeyance that wholehearted commitment to God. Even in material things, that's going to get you in trouble. You don't fix the leaky roof, it's just going to get worse. You don't pull the ivy off of the plants, it's going to choke them to death. And so it is with spiritual things. We don't make a choice about God. We don't give ourselves wholeheartedly to Him. And the creeping immorality, creeping love of the world and covetousness is going to be harder and harder to root out. You know what happened when Elijah asked him on Mount Carmel, how long will you halt between two opinions? They gave him no answer. Because there is no answer. There is no defense for that kind of indecision. Oh, there were motives aplenty, I am sure. There's the desire for those favor with those in power. Ahab and Jezebel are Baal worshipers. They want to set up the Baal, so we don't want to be too disdainful about Baal. A lack of courage, perhaps. Instead of taking a stand and saying like those three Hebrew children did to Nebuchadnezzar, doesn't matter whether you put us in the fiery furnace, we're not going to fall down and worship that idol. No, they kind of went along with that. There are plenty who will choose to go along as opposed to suffering with God's people, persecution. Maybe they were just hedging their bets. Say, well, maybe there is something to this too. You know, we're going to worship God. I know God, but you know, maybe the Baals got something going for them. But the pagans, after all these years, have been worshiping them. They seem to be doing okay. So maybe there's something about that's okay. But you can't mix God with contemptible idols. That's just as true whether the idols are Dagon or Molech or Baal or the modern day idols of mammon and covetousness and science and any of the other modern equivalents that people put their confidence in for their eternal values. And of course, there's a problem of influence too, because it's like every one of them thought, like Elijah, I'm the only one left. God said, I've got 1,000 who still haven't bowed their knee to Baal. But they each one seemed to go through life thinking they were the only one. There were so few good role models for the young. There were so many in high places that were bad role models. Maybe some of them had that kind of a reason for halting between two opinions. Most always, though, it's just failure to consider what Isaiah keeps saying. My people don't consider. God says, come, let us reason together. And indeed, even in this case, here on Mount Carmel, He says, let's put it to the test one more time. How many tests do you need? How much evidence do you need? I don't know, but let's do a test one more time. And this is pretty decisive. They had had the evidence for them before. They had the evidence, as is written over and over in the Psalms, about how God had brought them out of Egyptian captivity across the Red Sea against the most formidable army in the whole world at the time of the Pharaoh, how He had fed them for 40 years with manna in the wilderness, how He'd brought them into the land with milk and honey. All of those things were impossible. We have even more evidence than that, because once they were taken into captivity by the Babylonians, people just don't come back from captivity. The 10 tribes of the north never came back from captivity, nor did any of the other hundreds of nations that the Babylonians captured and took into captivity. But the Jews did. They came back because they were God's people. They came back because that's where the seed was to be found. That's where Jesus was born. That's where the hope of all the world came from. God's not left himself without witnesses. There's enough evidence to make up our minds. Can't use that as an excuse. You have to decide. You just got to make up your mind. And that's the only way to be happy. That's what Moses told them with his last breath. Choose this day life. It's what Joshua told them in his farewell address. Choose this day whom you will serve. That's the example we see with Paul, who gave it all up, counted it all loss, that he might wholeheartedly follow Jesus Christ. That's what we need to do too. How long will we halt between two opinions? How long will we go without considering the implications of that? Hand in hand with Jesus. That's the only way to go into the future. Hand in hand with Jesus. Let's encourage one another as we stand and sing that song together.